And now, Chapter 19. Krishna defeats all the princes and takes Rukmini home to Dwarka. All the princes, led by Jarasandha, were very angry at Krishna's having kidnapped Rukmini. Struck by Rukmini's beauty, they had fallen from the backs of their horses and elephants. But now they began to stand up and properly arm themselves. Picking up their bows and arrows, they began to chastise Krishna on their chariots, horses, and elephants. To check their progress, the soldiers of the Yadu dynasty turned and faced them. Thus terrible fighting began between the two belligerent groups. The princes opposing Krishna, who were led by Jarasandha and were all expert in fighting, shot their arrows at the Yadu soldiers just as a cloud splashes the face of a mountain with torrents of rain. Gathered on the face of a mountain, a cloud does not move very much, and therefore the force of rain is much more severe on a mountain than anywhere else. The opposing princes were determined to defeat Krishna and recapture Rukmini from his custody, and they fought with him as severely as possible. Rukmini, seated by the side of Krishna, saw arrows raining from the opposing party onto the faces of the soldiers of Yadu. In a fearful attitude, she looked upon Krishna's face, expressing her gratefulness that he had taken such a great risk for her sake only. Her eyes moving, she appeared sorry, and Krishna, who could immediately understand her mind, encouraged her with these words: "My dear Rukmini, don't worry. Please rest assured that the soldiers of the Yadu dynasty will kill all the opposing soldiers without delay." As Krishna was speaking with Rukmini, the commanders of the Yadu dynasty soldiers, headed by Lord Balaram, who is also known as Sankarshan, as well as Gadadhar, not tolerating the defiant attitude of the opposing soldiers, began to strike their horses, elephants, and chariots with arrows. As the fighting progressed, the princes and soldiers of the enemy began to fall from their horses, elephants, and chariots. Within a short time, millions of severed heads, decorated with helmets and earrings, had fallen on the battlefield. The soldiers' hands were cut off, along with their bows and arrows and clubs. One head was piled upon another, and one horse upon another. All the infantry soldiers, as well as their camels, elephants, and asses, fell with severed heads. When the enemy, headed by Jarasandha, found that they were gradually being defeated by the soldiers of Krishna, they thought it unwise to risk losing in the battle for the sake of Shishupal. Shishupal himself should have fought to rescue Rukmini from the hands of Krishna. But when the soldiers saw that Shishupal was not competent to fight with Krishna, they decided not to lose their strength unnecessarily. Therefore, they ceased fighting and dispersed. Some of the princes, as a matter of etiquette, appeared before Shishupal. They saw that Shishupal was discouraged, like one who has lost his wife. His face appeared dried up. He had lost all his energy, and all the luster of his body had disappeared. They addressed Shishupal thus: "Our dear Shishupal, don't be discouraged in this way. You belong to the royal order and are the chief amongst the fighters. There is no question of distress or happiness for a person like you, because neither of these conditions is everlasting. So take courage. Don't be disappointed by this temporary reverse. After all, we are not the final actors. As puppets dance in the hands of a magician, we are all dancing by the will of the Supreme. And according to His grace alone, we suffer distress or enjoy happiness. We should therefore be equipoised in all circumstances. The whole catastrophe of the defeat was due to the envious nature of Rukmini's elder brother, Rukmi. Having seen his sister forcibly taken away by Krishna after he had planned to marry her to Shishupal, Rukmi was frustrated. So he and Shishupal, his friend and intended brother-in-law, returned to their respective homes. Rukmi, very much agitated, was determined to teach Krishna a lesson personally. He called for his own soldiers, a military phalanx consisting of several thousand elephants, horses, chariots, and infantry. And equipped with this military strength, he began to follow Krishna to Dvarka. To show his prestige, Rukmi promised all the returning kings, "You could not help Shishupal marry my sister Rukmini, but I cannot allow Rukmini to be taken away by Krishna. I shall teach him a lesson. Now I am going to follow him." He presented himself as a big commander and vowed before all the princes, "Unless I kill Krishna in the fight and bring back my sister from his clutches, I shall not return to my capital city, Kundin. I make this vow before you all, and you will see that I shall fulfill it." After thus vibrating all these boasting words, Rukmi immediately got on his chariot and told his chariot driver to pursue Krishna. He said, "I want to fight with him immediately. This cowherd boy has become proud of his tricky way of fighting with Kshatriyas. But today I shall teach him a good lesson. Because he had the impudence to kidnap my sister, I, with my sharp arrows, shall teach him very good lessons indeed." Thus, this unintelligent man, Rukmi, ignorant of the extent of the strength and activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, voiced his impudent threats. In great stupidity, he soon stood before Krishna, telling him repeatedly, "Stop for a minute and fight with me." After saying this, he drew his bow and directly shot three forceful arrows against Krishna's body. Then he condemned Krishna as the most abominable descendant of the Yadu dynasty and asked him to stand before him for a minute so that he could teach him a good lesson. "You are carrying away my sister, just like a crow stealing clarified butter meant for use in a sacrifice. You are proud of your military strength, but you cannot fight according to the regulative principles. You have stolen my sister. Now I shall relieve you of your false prestige. You can keep my sister in your possession only until I beat you to the ground for good with my arrows." Lord Krishna, after hearing all these crazy words from Rukmi, immediately shot an arrow and severed the string of Rukmi's bow, making him unable to use another arrow. Rukmi immediately took another bow and shot another five arrows at Krishna. Being attacked for the second time, Krishna again severed Rukmi's bowstring. Rukmi took a third bow, and Krishna again cut off its string. This time, to teach Rukmi a lesson, Krishna personally shot six arrows at him, and then shot another eight arrows, killing four horses with four arrows, killing the chariot driver with another arrow, and chopping off the upper portion of Rukmi's chariot, including the flag, with the remaining three arrows. Rukmi, having run out of arrows, took assistance from swords, shields, tridents, lances, and similar weapons used for fighting hand to hand. But Krishna immediately broke them all in the same way. Being repeatedly baffled in his attempts, Rukmi took his sword and ran swiftly toward Krishna, just as a fly proceeds toward a fire. But as soon as Rukmi reached Krishna, Krishna cut his weapon to pieces. This time, Krishna took out his sharp sword and was about to kill him immediately. But Rukmi's sister, Rukmini, understanding that this time Krishna would not excuse her brother, fell down at Krishna's lotus feet and in a very grievous tone, trembling with great fear, began to plead with her husband. Rukmini first addressed Krishna as Yogeshwar. Yogeshwar means one who is possessed of inconceivable opulence and energy. Krishna possesses inconceivable opulence and energy, whereas Rukmini's brother had only limited military potency. Krishna is immeasurable, whereas her brother was measured in every step of his life. Therefore, Rukmi was not comparable even to an insignificant insect before the unlimited power of Krishna. She also addressed Krishna as the God of the gods. There are many powerful demigods, such as Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, Indra, Chandra, and Varun. But Krishna is the Lord of all these gods, whereas Rukmini's brother was not only an ordinary human being, but in fact the lowest of all, because he had no understanding of Krishna. In other words, a human being who has no conception of the actual position of Krishna is the lowest in human society. Then Rukmini addressed Krishna as Mahabhuj, which means with unlimited strength. She also addressed Krishna as Jagatpati, the master of the whole cosmic manifestation. In comparison, her brother was only an ordinary prince. In this way, Rukmini compared the position of Rukmi with that of Krishna, and very feelingly pleaded with her husband not to kill her brother just at the auspicious time of her being united with Krishna, but to excuse him. In other words, she displayed her real position as a woman. She was happy to get Krishna as her husband at the moment when her marriage to another was to be performed, but she did not want it to be at the loss of her elder brother, who, after all, loved his young sister and wanted to hand her over to one who, according to his own calculations, was a better man. While Rukmini was praying to Krishna for the life of her brother, her whole body trembled, and because of her anxiety, her face appeared to dry up. Her throat became choked, and due to her trembling, the ornaments on her body loosened and fell scattered on the ground. In this manner, when Rukmini was very much perturbed, she fell down on the ground, and Lord Krishna immediately became compassionate and agreed not to kill the foolish Rukmi. But at the same time, he wanted to give him some light punishment. So he tied him up with a piece of cloth and snipped at his mustache, beard, and hair, keeping some spots here and there. While Krishna was dealing with Rukmi in this way, The soldiers of the Yadu dynasty, commanded by Balaram himself, broke the whole strength of Rukmi's army, just as an elephant in a tank discards the feeble stem of a lotus flower. In other words, as an elephant breaks the whole construction of a lotus flower while bathing in a reservoir of water, the military strength of the Yadus broke up Rukmi's forces. When the commanders of the Yadu dynasty came back to see Krishna, they were all surprised to see the condition of Rukmi. Lord Balaram became especially compassionate for his sister-in-law, who was newly married to his brother. To please Rukmini, Balaram personally untied Rukmi, and to further please her, Balaram, as the elder brother of Krishna, spoke some words of chastisement. "Krishna, your action is not at all satisfactory," he said. "This is an abomination, very much contrary to our family tradition. To cut someone's hair and shave his mustache and beard is almost comparable to killing him. Whatever Rukmi might have been, he is now our brother-in-law, a relative of our family, and you should not have put him in such a condition." After this, to pacify Rukmini, Lord Balaram said to her, "You should not be sorry that your brother has been made odd-looking. Everyone suffers or enjoys the results of his own actions." Lord Balaram wanted to impress upon Rukmini that she should not have been sorry for the consequences her brother suffered due to his actions. There was no need of being too affectionate towards such a brother. Lord Balaram again turned toward Krishna and said, "My dear Krishna, a relative, even though he commits such a blunder and deserves to be killed, should be excused. For when such a relative is conscious of his own fault, that consciousness itself is like death. Therefore, there is no need to kill him." Balaram again turned toward Rukmini and informed her that the current duty of the Kshatriya in human society is so fixed that according to the principles of fighting, one's own brother may become an enemy. Then a Kshatriya does not hesitate to kill his own brother. In other words, Lord Balaram wanted to instruct Rukmini that Rukmi and Krishna were right in not showing mercy to each other in the fighting, despite the family consideration that they happen to be brothers-in-law. Sri Balaram informed Rukmini that Kshatriyas are typical emblems of the materialistic way of life. They become puffed up whenever there is a question of material acquisition. Therefore, when there is a fight between two belligerent Kshatriyas for kingdom, land, wealth, women, prestige, or power, they try to put one another into the most abominable condition. Balaram instructed Rukmini that her affection toward her brother Rukmi, who had created enmity with so many persons, was a perverse consideration befitting an ordinary materialist. Her brother's character was not at all admirable, considering his treatment toward other friends. And yet Rukmini, as an ordinary woman, was affectionate toward him. He was not fit to be her brother, and still Rukmini was lenient toward him. "Besides that," Balaram continued, "the consideration that a person is neutral or is one's friend or enemy is generally made by persons in the bodily concept of life. Such foolish persons are bewildered by the illusory energy of the Supreme Lord. The spirit soul is of the same pure quality in any embodiment of matter, but those who are not sufficiently intelligent see only the bodily differences between animals and men, literates and illiterates, rich and poor, which cover the pure spirit soul. Such differences, observed merely on the basis of the body, are exactly like the differences between fires in terms of the various types of fuel they consume. Whatever the size and shape of the fuel, there is no such variety of size and shape in the fire which comes out. Similarly, in the sky, there are no differences in size or shape. In this way, Balaram appeased them by his moral and ethical instructions. He stated further, "This body is part of the material manifestation. The living entity or spirit soul, being in contact with matter, is transmigrating due to illusory enjoyment from one body to another, and that transmigration is known as material existence. This contact of the living entity with the material manifestation has neither integration nor disintegration. My dear chaste sister-in-law, the spirit soul is, of course, the cause of this material body, just as the sun is the cause of sunlight, eyesight, and the forms of material manifestation. The example of the sunshine and the material manifestation is very appropriate in understanding the living entity's contact with the material world. In the morning, the sun rises, and the heat and light gradually expand throughout the whole day. The sun is the cause of all material shapes and forms, for it is due to the sun that integration and disintegration of material elements take place. But as soon as the sun sets, the whole manifestation is no longer connected to the sun, which has passed from one place to another. When the sun passes from the eastern to the western hemisphere, the results of the interactions due to the sunshine in the eastern hemisphere remain. But the sunshine itself is visible again in the western hemisphere. Similarly, the living entity accepts or produces different bodies and different bodily relationships in a particular circumstance. But as soon as he gives up the present body and accepts another, he has nothing to do with the former body. Similarly, the living entity has nothing to do with the next body he accepts. He is always free from the contact of this bodily contamination. Therefore, the appearance and disappearance of the body have nothing to do with the living entity, just as the waxing and waning of the moon have nothing to do with the moon. When the moon waxes, we falsely think that the moon is developing, and when it wanes, we think the moon is decreasing. Actually, the moon, as it is always the same. It has nothing to do with such visible activities of waxing and waning. Consciousness of material existence can be compared to sleeping and dreaming. When a man sleeps, he dreams of many non-factual happenings, and as a result of dreaming, he becomes subject to different kinds of distress and happiness. Similarly, when a person is in the dream of material consciousness, he suffers the effects of accepting a body and giving it up again in material existence. Opposite to this material consciousness is Krishna consciousness. In other words, when a man is elevated to the platform of Krishna consciousness, he becomes free from this false conception of life. In this way, Sri Balaram instructed Rukmini and Krishna in spiritual knowledge. He addressed his sister-in-law thus, "Sweet smiling Rukmini, do not be aggrieved by false motives caused by ignorance. Only because of false notions does one become unhappy, but one can immediately remove this unhappiness by discussing the philosophy of actual life. be happy on that platform only. After hearing such enlightening instructions from Sri Balaram, Rukmini immediately became pacified and happy, and adjusted her mind, which was very much afflicted by the degraded position of her brother Rukmi. As far as Rukmi was concerned, his promise was not fulfilled, nor was his mission successful. He had come from home with his soldiers and military phalanx to defeat Krishna and release his sister. But on the contrary, he lost all his soldiers and military strength. He was personally degraded and very sorry, but by the grace of the Lord, he could continue his life to its fixed destination. Because he was a Kshatriya, he could remember his promise that he would not return to his capital city, Kundin, without killing Krishna and releasing his sister, which he had failed to do. Therefore, he decided in anger not to return to his capital city, and he constructed a small cottage in the village known as Bojakot, where he began to reside for the rest of his life. After defeating all the opposing elements and forcibly carrying away Rukmini, Krishna brought her to his capital city, Dvarka, and then married her according to the Vedic ritualistic principle. After this marriage, Krishna became the king of the Yadus at Dvarka. On the occasion of his marriage with Rukmini, all the inhabitants were happy, and in every house there were great ceremonies. The inhabitants of Dvarka city were so pleased that they dressed themselves with the nicest possible ornaments and garments and went to present gifts according to their means to the newly married couple, Krishna and Rukmini. All the houses of Yadupuri or Dvarka were decorated with flags, festoons, and flowers. Each and every house had an extra gate specifically prepared for this occasion. And on both sides of the gate were big water jugs filled with water. The whole city was flavored by the burning of fine incense, and at night there was illumination from thousands of lamps decorating every building. The entire city appeared jubilant on the occasion of Lord Krishna's marriage with Rukmini. Everywhere in the city, there were profuse decorations of banana trees and betel nut trees. These two trees are considered very auspicious in happy ceremonies. At the same time, there was an assembly of many elephants who carried the respective kings of different friendly kingdoms. It is the habit of the elephant that whenever he sees some small plants and trees, out of his sportive and frivolous nature, he uproots the trees and throws them hither and thither. The elephants assembled on this occasion also scattered the banana and betel nut trees. But in spite of such intoxicated action, the whole city, with the trees thrown here and there, looked very nice. The friendly kings of the Kurus and the Pandavas were represented by Bhishma, Dhritarashtra, the five Pandu brothers, King Drupad, King Santardhan, and Rukmini's father, Bhishma. Because of Krishna's kidnapping Rukmini, there was initially some misunderstanding between the two families, but Bhishma, king of Vidarbha, being approached by Sri Balaram, and persuaded by many saintly persons, was induced to participate in the marriage ceremony of Krishna and Rukmini. Although the incident of the kidnapping was not a very happy occurrence in the kingdom of Vidarbha, kidnapping was not an unusual affair among Kshatriyas. Kidnapping was, in fact, current in almost all marriages. Anyway, King Bhishmak was, from the very beginning, inclined to hand over his beautiful daughter to Krishna. In one way or another, his purpose had been served, and so he was pleased to join the marriage ceremony, even though his eldest son was degraded in the fight. It is mentioned in the Padma Purana that Maharaj Nanda and the cowherd boys of Vrindavan joined the marriage ceremony. Kings from the kingdoms of Kuru, Srinjaya, Kekaya, Vidarbha, and Kunti came to Dvorka on this occasion with all their royal paraphernalia. The story of Rukmini's being kidnapped by Krishna was poeticized, and professional readers recited it everywhere. All the assembled kings, and their daughters especially, were struck with wonder and very pleased upon hearing the chivalrous activities of Krishna. In this way, all the visitors, as well as the inhabitants of Dvarka city, were joyful to see Krishna and Rukmini together. In other words, the Supreme Lord, the maintainer of everyone, and the goddess of fortune were united, and all the people felt extremely jubilant. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purport of the second volume, 19th chapter of Krishna. Krishna defeats all the princes and takes Rukmini home to Dvarka.